Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and liberally butter it on both sides. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host this week is Mo Poplar. Mo designs and publishes games under the brand Ashy Feet Games. He's also the host of the Show and Tell podcast over at the RPG Academy, an interview show that brings on a tabletop RPG designer each week to talk about something cool they're working on. And he was the first ever person recommended to me by a previous co-host, all the way back in episode 1, when Ray Chow told me to look him up. Perhaps most importantly of all, Mo was my ride up to Big Bad Con this past fall from LA. I love talking games with him, and today we got to do that for all of you. Mo brought in playbooks, like the idea of playbooks at large, character archetypes within a game, each with bespoke rules and mechanics that make that archetype a distinct play experience and flavor. That'd be a lot for one podcast, but Mo had a very particular symptom of playbooks that he wanted to talk about. How playbook choice, and really character customization at large, is an avenue of communication between everyone at the table that he thinks is really overlooked by many designers and players. This is one of those rare episodes of this show that is almost more about player advice than design. It's a kind of episode I wish we did more of. Anyway, talking to your table about what you want is good, and we should probably all be doing more of it, whether that's through playbooks or otherwise. Okay, here is Mo Poplar with playbooks and communication. Mo, thanks for being here on Dice Exploder.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I love this show. Just talking about the crunchy bits and mechanics of games and just how even the bits that don't look crunchy are crunchy, and I get to co-play today. So thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. So you brought on essentially playbooks as a concept at large. Let's start with, when you think about playbooks, what are you referring to?
So for me, a playbook is, it's a character sheet, but it's a character sheet with a lot of prompts and choices that kind of limit the player's imagination, but they constrain the player choices to what actually fits in the game world. And yeah. I think, you know, some people might say, well, I want to do what I want to do. But if you choose what's going on the playbook, you can communicate to the GM what kind of game you want to be in. And the GM can communicate to you what kind of is in store for the players, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So back when I was a wee lad playing Dungeons and Dragons and Champions, and just the concept of somebody handing you a blank character sheet and how you could read all the books, you could build your character, and come back, and that would not necessarily be appropriate for the gaming session of the day. And there was definitely a sense of that teacher game that I hated, where it was like, guess what's in my hand? You know, guess the thing that I'm thinking about. And if nobody guessed it, you're all wrong.
Sir, what do you mean there exactly?
Well, I've been in the classroom on both sides of the line as teacher and as student. And there are definitely teachers who would, they'd be fishing for an answer and, you know, they keep it going a little too long while the students clearly weren't thinking about the thing they were thinking about. And I feel like that sometimes is what it is when you go home and make a character in a trad game. You show up and your character may or may not be appropriate for the game scenario in a D&D session, but you got a character. So let's get started. Playbook just take a lot of that questioning out, and they kind of almost structuralize a session zero. And so you're playing a game, and a lot of these, I'm going to say new games, I mean, these games have been out for more than a decade, but in comparison to the trad games, a lot of these newer games, you could just hand out a couple playbooks, and so much information gets communicated just by the players looking at the playbooks. Even if they've never heard of or played the game before. And, you know, it just creates a conversation starter for everyone to be on the same page for what's going to happen in the gaming session. For example, you look in Blades in the Dark, there's a cutter, right? And the cutter is your brawler. He's your muscle guy. And you might look on the cutter sheet and see a couple options that could take the game in very different directions if the GM is paying attention. So for example, if the cutter decides that they want to be a ghost fighter, that is to say, they want to have potency against ghosts, I don't have to know what potency means in this game as a mechanic to understand, oh, so with my bare hands, I can handle and maybe, you know, mishandle the supernatural. And I think that's cool. And I think that's the way that my character wants to solve problems. And the GM can then from that take, oh, they want to handle supernatural problems. We should add some supernatural elements to this particular session, scenario, or campaign arc. And, you know, playbooks just really become a level of discourse between the player and the GM before the game even gets started.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the main topic today is how playbooks are this avenue of communication, I think not just between players and GM, but between players and other players and between like game designer and GM and table. It's whole avenue of communication that people are, I think, subconsciously aware of, but not typically consciously paying a lot of attention to.
Right. And so I've heard a lot of people talk about zero prep games. And, you know, I think there's a vast and growing space of that. But I see these games that use playbooks as a mechanic kind of leaning toward that direction. Because at the point where somebody gives you a sheet and says, you know, circle three things and we can get started, the player who looks at those three things and says, ooh, I want vanilla and strawberry, they have an opportunity to, you know, add to the menu that's going to be for dessert tonight.
Yeah, assuming that the other people at the table are listening to their choices. It's really easy. I've played in Blades in the Dark games where a cutter comes in and picks Ghost Hands. I can't remember what it's called. The ability you were talking about earlier. It's like, I can punch ghosts. And then I, as the GM, just like, don't put any ghosts in the game unless they go looking for them.
Right.
And then you have this person whose whole thing was, I want to play a game where I can punch ghosts and no ghosts show up. Like, that's a missed opportunity. It's a communication breakdown.
Well, for me, this is a topic we're talking about because I think a lot of people look at the playbook and they don't see some of the opportunity available. In Blades in the Dark, the playbook also requires you ask, who on this short list of NPCs are you friends or rivals with? You know, and a GM might really pick up on that. But I don't know that a lot of GMs are aware that, yeah, like, this is kind of the first volley of the game, as it were.
Yeah, totally. All right, why don't we start a little bit with talking about the part of this communication that is between designer and table?
Yeah.
Like, we have in the notes here, you want to talk about Candela Obscura?
Sure. So I've seen designers start giving the playbooks names that really become evocative and suggestive of what's going on in the game. And so you got games like Candela Obscura, where you have what appears to me a lot of playbooks, but they all kind of fall into a certain kind of category. So you have doctors and professors and journalists, but you also have occultists and magicians. I don't mean like mages from D&D, but magicians, people who can do magical tricks and optical illusions, you know, with practical effects. And just this list of playbooks, along with the soldier and the explorer, you look at the choices, and for me at least, it really sets the tone. Okay, we're playing something that is in a thematic tone that's maybe between the 1920s and maybe the 1950s or 60s. You know, like, it could be pulpy, could be Cthulhu-y, but these people are described as their jobs.
Yeah.
And that is how we're going to approach keeping the Eldritch horrors at bay, at least in the case of Candela Obscura. And when you pair that up with the fact that one of these people is a professor, it's like, oh, okay, we may be in over our heads in this, but how do I want to feel like, as a character, I can move through the world and maybe hope to have an effect on the things in the dark, you know?
Yeah. The other interesting thing I see in this like list of playbooks is I read magician first and I think, oh, okay, maybe this is just sort of the general wizard playbook. And then we're just putting a sort of like 20Z kind of name on it. And cool, we've got that flavor. But then the next one is occultist.
Right.
And I'm like, wait, that's what I thought a magician was. now suddenly the way I'm thinking about magician is much more of the like on stage doing tricks thing that you were describing, because it's specifically in opposition to occultists. And that's really useful too in sort of taking the collective of playbooks as a unit.
Exactly. So I like Root's interesting game as an RPG, because you play the board game and you get to play these woodland creatures who have cute and fuzzy art, but they're not doing cute and fuzzy things, right?
Yeah.
And so like you look at the Root playbooks and you have the adjutor who is kind of like a paladin. You got the thief, you got the scoundrel, and you got the vagrant. And
yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is, in order to keep peace in the woodland, we're going to be playing characters who either are very law oriented or very law skirting. And if we all play together, we all have to figure out how that works, you know, which starts to place doubt on how lawful is the law, or is the law also part of this gray morality play? And this is just putting playbooks out on the table, just giving the playbooks as an option. Everybody suddenly gets like a taste, a flavor. It's kind of like when you smell rosemary and garlic. All right, I have an idea of what I'm about to get myself into.
Yeah. All right, let's go a little bit more to the conversation at the table itself. I really love the examples you brought in from Monster of the Week here, and how some of those playbooks in particular really set the tone for the entire group. And I'm curious to hear you talk about what those playbooks kind of look like and how those fit into this for you.
So Monster of the Week is, in my opinion, a brilliant game, because it just really gives you this evocative air of Skulder and Mully, Mulder and Scully, sorry, maybe Men in Black, maybe Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
And those are three totally different genres of approaching dealing with monsters, right? But as players start choosing their playbooks, the playbooks are built to bring certain elements to bear in the game. So, for example, you have The Chosen. And the playbook straight up says, this is kind of like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. This is kind of like Michael Landon's character from Highway to Heaven. This is the person who was sent here to do a job. And that playbook comes with a thing called Fate, which is, it is signposting to the GM, this is the overarching theme of the whole game. And that feels like a very bold thing to do, say, but the playbooks are kind of balanced in a such a way that the fate of the Chosen doesn't really step on the toes of any of the other playbooks. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a level of brilliance.
A thing that's kind of going on here with The Chosen, and I know also The Professional, which sort of is attached to a Men in Black style organization. They all are playbooks that have a built-in relationship to some sort of part of the setting that is outside the core player adventuring party.
That's right.
And it's really easy to imagine someone choosing The Professional as their playbook, and then everyone else in the party being like, oh, that's cool, we'll just all be members of this organization, but you're like the point person. And in that world, it's nice that someone sort of created a direction for the campaign to go in and everyone got on board with that. But if other people aren't into that, you might have a Chosen and a Professional in the same party. And at that point, you know that those two things are probably going to like come into conflict with each other, and that can be what the game's about, and the GM can know that, the other players can know that, and it's I don't know, I just think that there's so much strength in establishing relationships early in the game so that you know what parts of the world are going to be interesting that you are going to be pushing off of and that are going to be important to you.
And you know, you mentioned earlier about the conversation in between players. Like, there's absolutely plenty of room for that. Maybe as the Crooked, that is actually the group of people I'm from, but you as a professional, you and they have a much better relationship than I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like in the same way that me picking Ghost Hands and Blades in the Dark is a signal to my GM to put some fucking ghosts in here, me picking the professional is in a way a signal to all of the players, hey, I want you to get your shit to come mess up my relationship with this professional organization.
Right. Right. And what happens in the introducing each other, in the preparing for the question amongst characters, the playbook requires everybody gets a opportunity now that they have made some of their decisions to maybe change or adjust their decisions to yes and something that like sounded way funner than what they saw on their sheet.
Yeah.
You know, or first imagined as being evocative from their sheet, you know, or it gives players an opportunity to kind of stand in conflict with that.
Yeah, totally.
And listen, I love it. This kind of all came up for me when I decided to run a particular type of Monster of the Week game. And the first thing that occurred to me was my NPC is going to be the professional. I don't want any of the players to be a professional. You know, like this game is going to be what happens when it happens to you. And when you as a GM are approaching this with something in mind, suddenly you kind of need to steer the conversation around these playbooks and maybe take some out of contention.
Yeah.
Or you almost, with some of these games, you can't come to the game with like a campaign arc or a session in mind and just hand out playbooks because that can be unfun. But yeah, if the players get really excited about something they see, especially if they know that their friend who's running this is doing it for the first time, you may want to just flag it.
Well, I feel like a really recurring theme of advice sort of across all parts of life, but also on like RPG advice subreddits and stuff like that is just talk to your players, just talk to your table, just talk to people.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, if you're having troubles in your relationship, just talk to each other is the thing that gets said. And I feel like the thing we're saying here is that there's a conversation here about what is the target of your game, of your story. What is our intentions for this? Mm-hmm. And it's worth having the explicit conversation to get on the same page as that, not just sort of making implicit decisions based on move choices and stuff. And the move choices and playbook choices are a great way to start that conversation and find the primary topics that we're going to discuss. But knowing, hey, we should be talking about this at all is a really important thing. And in that way, I also, you know, we kicked around the idea of calling this episode Playbooks and Safety Tools.
Yeah.
Because this conversation kind of feels like a safety tool. You don't want to get four sessions into a Monster of the Week campaign and then realize, oh, this is Men in Black and I thought it was Scooby-Doo.
Right.
But I feel like this is also a reflection on safety tools, that all of the best safety tools are just talk about it. like this is a safety tool, not because like, oh, it just so happens that this is a safety tool, but because all the best safety tools are have this exact conversation.
Listen, this is so much it. And, you know, I guess I respond to playbooks as such a great thing because I have made my second story thief in D&D. And then in session one, we go into a dungeon and I'm just like, all right, well, like by the time I'm level three, I'll be useful.
So on that note, actually, of Dungeons and Dragons and thinking about your second story thief, what in your mind distinguishes Dungeons and Dragons classes from playbooks in this way? Why don't they work like this?
Oh, so you're asking for a whole nother podcast, Sam.
in order to, see if you can give me the 5-minute version.
I think the 5-minute version is this. Today, there is enough eyes and critique of Dungeons and Dragons that people will tell you about S tier and F tier classes and subclasses. And so in D&D, you could really like the theme of a thing because maybe you read a fantasy novel and you want to do that thing. And it could be mechanically sucky. It could be mechanically not as advantageous as other things in the game world. And one of the things that is inherent in the playbook and special moves approach is that you're not mechanizing things, you're evoking things. You're creating this really colorful language that doesn't always tell you how it mechanically affects the game, but how it narratively affects the game. And so like to compare what's going on in D&D, which tries to, within an inch of itself, mechanize everything that it's talking about, playbooks are almost like a suggestion. They're, let's do this mood thing, you know? And Blades in the Dark, if we go back to the cutter, there's a special move called a savage. And this is when you do a act of wanton destruction and then make a command, you get plus one die. And, you know, I read that and the first thing that comes to my mind is Wolverine, you know, from the X-Men. The character that's going to jump in, like, do a bunch of destruction and then, like, make a command, you know, and
he's going to cut one guy's head off and tell everyone else to go home.
Exactly. Or shred, you know, a mannequin with claw coming out of his hands. And people get the hint. And that, to me, it's about the one die in command, but it kind of steers your character in an attitude and a direction. And I think that is a thing that D&D isn't necessarily doing.
Yeah. I do think on the subject of D&D classes versus playbooks, your point is really good. I also think that there's just a different culture of play between the two communities that really changes this too. Because you're talking a little bit in D&D about how the problem with some of the playbook choices is power gaming. Essentially, like, people are going to be out here telling you, don't choose X, choose Y, because Y is more powerful. And in Apocalypse World, people just aren't going to do that, even though there are absolutely moves in Apocalypse World that are more powerful than other moves, that like give you more agency in the game, that make your character more of a badass and more able to do ridiculous things. And I think that D&D has a much broader culture of play than Apocalypse World does. I'm playing in a D&D group right now on a semi-regular basis that is much closer to a story game kind of community. I chose the nature path for my paladin because I wanted to do cool nature shit.
Right,
and
right.
Everyone at the table was like, good, that's great. And in that way, it sort of does act more like a playbook.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also true that in the culture of D&D and with that particular DM, she just kind of like wrote the campaign story that we're going through, and that's fine, but it's not really taking into account any of our characters, because I think that the D&D culture of play is very much not about that. You're all choosing what a quote-unquote fantasy archetype to do some kind of fantasy story. It's assumed that you're going to be doing one particular thing, even though in practice that's really not true.
Right, and so if you want to play a bard who goes into Ravenloft, like,
yeah,
like,
you better be a goth fucking bard.
You better be a goth fucking bard. You better, like,
or you better know what you're getting into. Like, maybe the thing you want to do is watch your happy go lucky fucko, like, slowly descend into madness.
Exactly.
And, yeah, great.
You know, likewise, you mentioned Apocalypse World. I looked at some of the playbooks over there and I steered away from talking about anything in particular because, I mean, Apocalypse World is the first PBTA game. And like, they just do such a great job of the thing that some of these games are absolutely not doing because they're much more tight and specific a game.
Yeah.
Which is, it allows for some of these special moves to be social.
Because
we're going to play a game where the problems that need to be resolved are social. It allows for some of these to be emotional because we're going to play a game that has to do with emotion, which has to do with morale, which has to do with, like, when comparing Blades in the Dark to D&D is a tough thing to do, right? Because D&D is saying you could do anything in this magical world, but clearly everything is about fighting. And Blades is saying, how are you going to steal, kill, and larceny your way into retirement. And yeah. I think, in my opinion, Blades is a more successful game just because it's just not trying to eat the whole horse.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to have a real conflict that revolves around you trying to govern in Blades in the Dark.
Yeah.
And in D&D, that can happen. It just doesn't have sophisticated tools for negotiating it.
Yeah,
so
totally.
Instead of trying to do everything, be all things to all people, Blades in the Dark is like, nah, you're either going to steal it, you're going to kill it,
yeah.
drug dealer. And so I think there are other games, and that's why I kind of threw Monster of the Week in there, that are definitely going to try to approach the problem in a way that may or may not resolve in combat. You know,
yes.
There's Monster of the Week is talking all day long about having extra armor here and doing extra damage there. But there are a handful of tools in there that are about solving problems in ways that don't involve combat. And Apocalypse World is got entire RP tracks that have nothing to do with getting into a fight.
Yeah. I mean, Apocalypse World is a game that's interesting in that it is sort of all about violence, but so much of it is about avoiding violence.
Yes.
Or recovering from violence, or threatening violence, negotiating around violence, that it becomes exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about, even though violence is sort of always present in the world.
Because a lot of it is emotional and systematic violence that
yeah.
you actually cannot win.
Yeah.
So another thing I like about playbooks is, and this is for better or for worse as a game designer, they don't require that every player show up knowing the game inside and out. You can get a taste, you can get a flavor, you can want to do a thing for a session and jump right into a game in 20 or 30 minutes because the playbook does a good enough job onboarding you into the themes of the world, into the ethos of the world, and to the morality of the world. And then you figure out how you are going to solve problems in the world. And as you introduce yourselves to other characters, you know, you get a chance to refine that, you know, on the fly, and then you jump in. And so to me, playbooks just do a really cool job of something that is an inherent problem in the RPG space. That is to say, people not reading and knowing the rules. But
yeah.
It does undermine the entire ethos of the game designer who spends all his time figuring out the system and how to make it work and all these edge cases.
Yeah. Well, I think coming at this conversation from the perspective of a game designer is something that we haven't done a lot of yet. And I really like the thing you were just talking about of, hey, FYI, playbooks should be everything a player needs to know to get to the table.
Yep.
Like on two sides or, you know, four sides of a piece of paper. Like, that's a great goal to have. I don't know that it's always accomplishable, but you can do most of it. And that's something to think about as a designer.
Well, let me just jump in there and kind of assert, as somebody
yeah.
who's personally tried to achieve that goal of getting, you know, everything you need to play the game on two sides of it, of a letter sized piece of paper. No PBTA game does that.
Yes.
They all have a second page of moves.
Yeah.
That are also evocative of the world and the problem that the players and characters are likely to face that
yeah.
kind of go hand in hand with the playbook. And so the idea that it happens on four sides of a letter-sized piece of paper, I think, is a good bar.
I have a counterexample,
uh-oh.
Which is The Warren. So The Warren uh-oh. Is a game where you're all rabbits. It's Watership Down.
Yes. Right?
You're running away from foxes and stuff in the forest trying to do your thing. But The Warren also doesn't have playbooks. It has a single character sheet that everyone uses, and everyone gets one special ability to sort of distinguish themselves from everyone else, and you get to pick your own stat array in as normal, but everyone is working from the same basic playbook. And I wanted to talk about how I think there are games out there like The Warren that do a good job of establishing the conversation we are talking about here, like the sort of group goals, the story goals, the archetype goals, without playbooks and other ways to do that. Because I think The Warren is a really good example. It's a game that is so hyper-specific in what it is about. You are rabbits. It's a horror movie.
Right.
You don't necessarily need to know that, like, I'm the wizard rabbit. Like, that's a cool game. Go play Mouse Ritter or go play some other game that does that. But the fact that we are simply a group of rabbits out there in trouble, in danger, scared for our Warren, scared for our lives, you just don't need more direction than that because the premise is so specific.
So I'm going to say something silly.
Uh-huh.
I think you can absolutely get away from the playbook.
Yeah.
You don't need the playbook. The playbook is not Thaco. It doesn't go back to the beginning days. I think the playbook does a very good job at the thing it does. I'm going to also say that in talking about the playbook, I had to draw the line at talking about character sheet design.
Yeah, well, we did just do another whole episode about that that people can go check
which
out.
Which is a totally different thing. And how just looking at your character sheet should encourage people to play more in the world. But what I will say is that playbooks do the thing they do very well. Can the same thing be done with moves? It absolutely can. I think you either need very evocative moves like Honey Heist, you know, I'm either going to honey or I'm going to heist. Lasers and Feelings, I'm either going to laser or I'm going to feeling. I think the playbook does a great job of... Now, so let me ask you a question. Is The Warren a campaignable game?
It is.
Okay.
I have never played it as a campaign game, notably. I think it is not intended for really long-term campaign. And the way it is structured as a campaign is that you play a session and then advance in time significantly and do another session and age up all the old characters.
Right.
So they start to die and they also start to have kids and you start playing as the kids.
Right.
So it becomes a generational thing. And that becomes an interesting story that comes in and brings more variety to the game in the way that maybe character archetype progression would do so in a more playbook based game.
And I was wondering, where was the rub? And I think that's it.
Yeah.
I think where a playbook really shines is by limiting your choices. You have this economy of choices and this economy of moves and stats and giving the promise that you can have it all one day.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that I haven't talked about, but I also don't think it's limited to playbooks.
Yeah.
Like D&D has its level progression. All of these games have their carrot for continuing to play with this character. And with playbooks, it's right there in the special moves. It's right there in being able to be more competent at your skills, etc.
I mean, there's also like whole genres of games that just don't have playbooks at all and aren't story games or are nowhere near the thing. Like the whole post-OSR kind of scene, like everything in there, it's just, there's no playbook. It's just your gear. Like the premise of the game is like you're out there doing the dungeon delving thing. Like it we did get into this a lot, but I wanted to at least bring up the fantasy DIY elf game kind of thing.
Yeah, honestly, I love the narrative stuff. And
yeah.
I am less interested in what you do with your magic sword than your relationship to your magic sword, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm much less interested in Vorpal Sword number 57 and much more interested in Mjolnir and the fact that everybody doesn't have a Mjolnir.
Yeah. Imagine, well, in the game Hunt, everyone does, and that's what the game's about.
Right.
Like, there's the playbook of you have a cool talking magic sword is, well, I want to play that playbook. Like, sign me up. And it has that relationship built into it. And
I agree, cool but thing. I guess just as a matter of taste, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that should be one playbook.
Yeah. So Two other kind of small things I just wanted to point out here. The first is, we talked about this a little bit, but I really want to emphasize this is a thing that can happen between GMs and players, but also between players.
Yeah.
Like, there are plenty of games out there that don't have GMs, but still have playbooks and benefit from all of this. The Dream Askew, Dream Apart, No Dice, No Masters, Belonging Outside Belonging thing is the sort of classic example. But in any of these kinds of games, like if you're in Monster of the Week and someone else picks the professional, you can run in there and say, you know, your Men in Black organization killed my dad.
Yep.
And that's just that's what that person wants. That's the thing that they are pumped for, is for a complicated relationship with their organization.
I love how Monster of the Week does it. I feel like they do it in a much more elegant way than Apocalypse World. But I think that's also because Monster of the Week is really trying to only do one thing. That is to say, chase monsters. Doesn't even say what you're doing with the monsters. If somebody plays a monstrous type, I think you're really opening a door for...
Yeah.
Like, now, we don't have a black and white relationship to monsters.
Yeah. Apocalypse Keys is a whole game.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say that I think I disagree that Monster of the Week is doing this better than Apocalypse World. I think they're just sort of different things for different genres, but I don't really want to belabor the point there.
I hope I didn't say better. I hope I said that Monster of the Week is doing it in a much more simple and elegant way. Like, sure. I think Apocalypse World, if you have more than a couple of archetypes for characters to choose from, I have always felt like I need to go and think about this.
The last thing I wanted to say is that I've been playing more two-player RPGs recently, and a couple of interesting games that I've noted are like StarCrossed and Tension and Godkiller are all two-player RPGs that have exactly two playbooks, one for one person and one for the other. And in Godkiller, it's a traditional GM player powered by the Apocalypse game, and it's meant to just be a traditional sort of PBTA structure, but you've only got one person in the party. And in Tension and StarCrossed, it's comparable in terms of, like, everyone has about the same amount of narrative control over the game, but the playbooks themselves work differently. They have different rules. You're allowed to do different things. They come with different mechanics. And I find that really interesting. In all of those games, I think there's much less conversation of the kind we've been having. There's much less of the conversation we've been talking about going on with the playbooks because there's only two. It's so much more of the conversation between designer and table rather than at the table.
Right.
But even in those games, you can still have the conversation. What do we want out of this? What are our expectations? It just might be less playbook specific.
It's interesting. It's kind of a space I don't know much about. I've heard a lot about StarCrossed. I haven't played it, but I think you have a real clear opportunity in two-player games to create a level of competency and inadequacy.
Yeah.
And to then make that thematic and tell a hell of a story.
Yeah.
It's right there.
Yeah. So how does this stuff come out in your work?
So in my game, Shibuya Knights, which is, it started off as a thin riff on Blades in the Dark and then went in a very different direction because I wanted it to be a lot more hopeful and a lot more fun. Like, I was intentional in creating playbooks that also had options to go against type. And so, you know, if you choose the warrior playbook, there are going to be kind of special moves that are more thematic to the warrior than to the combat, if that makes sense. Like, you are going to be able to kind of rouse the people. You know, the people know that you're a good person and that you have a good reputation. And so on a reputation roll, they come to your aid or they make sure the bad guy doesn't get away. And it was really important for me to make a game that was family friendly, where everything didn't have to be about combat. Likewise, there's a whole class called the Brewers, which I feel successful because I noticed during playtest people were attracted to, because, you know, when you say brewer, it doesn't really establish, well, is this guy a mage or a cleric or a fighter? Like, what do they do? And you have an opportunity with some of these playbooks to create these ideas and notions that ground people in the world again. And so people read the Brewer's Guild, and the first thing they do is say, oh, I have to tell the truth? I don't want to play this. Right? But, you know, it then establishes like, oh, those are the people with the moral authority, as opposed to the person named the Hustler, which, well, that is not the person with the moral authority.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when somebody says they want to take the special feat of look good doing it, and they want to swing from a chandelier.
Yeah.
I think that kind of becomes the heart of the game. And you can create playbooks that specifically say, do something awesome. This isn't a game about physics or reality. It's really about having fun.
Mo, thanks so much for coming on Dice Exploder.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I'm a big fan of the show. It's a show I wish I started, and I'm glad that I don't have to do every week.
Thanks again to Mo for being here. You can find Mo's work and links and everything at ashyfeet.com or in the show notes, and the podcast he hosts, Show and Tell, over at RPG Academy. As always, you can find me on socials at S. Dunawald or on the Dice Exploder Discord. Our logo was designed by Sporgery, and our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time!